1967, the summer of love, the Beatles released that song. What do you think? Is all you need really love? I guess it depends on what kind. Because we use love in a weird way. Sometimes we overuse it and undervalue it. Like you can love pizza and your parents and you say the same thing, right? I love them. I love it. This week, today, this afternoon, Super Bowl Sunday, some of you love the Eagles, right? Some of you love their opponent, the Kansas City Swifties. Some of you just love football and the chili that you're going to eat, all that stuff. We say love about so many things that it just kind of loses its sense. And then on the other side, sometimes we make love the be-all, end-all of life. That whatever we love actually is the most real thing about our identity. We are really confused about love. So whenever we say that that's all that you need, I have questions, and you should too. So for the next 4 weeks, we're going to be looking at love in all its various forms. In that same time frame when the Beatles released the song All You Need Is Love, C.S. Lewis, one of my heroes and one of my favorite theologians, released a book called The Four Loves. It was one of his last works. And in that, he took upon the task of trying to help us understand what love really is. See, our English language has just this one word for love, and so it makes it kind of difficult to know what you mean when you say it. But in Greek, and the lens through which Lewis writes, there are at least four ways to speak about love. This allows for some precision whenever we're talking about things like jelly rolls or our children. And so these are the four ways that we express love. Four Greek words. First, the word storge, that's the one we're going to look at today. Storge love is kind of like affection. It's based on familiarity. It's kind of a foundational love that a lot of us experience in life and everyone wants to. And then there's the Greek word for love called eros, and that's more the sexual, romantic love. It's a powerful force that drives, and it's also the one that sometimes we tend to think of most and put on the pedestal when we talk about love. Then there's the word philia, which is the love of a great friend. It's been said that philia love is like two people who stand side by side looking at the same thing, whereas eros love is two people who stand face to face admiring each other. And then there's the final one, and this love is the supernatural one. It's the one that only we can experience when God gives it to us, and it's the word called agape. So each of these loves allow us to understand something about the way we were designed and also about what God is up to in the world. Just to give you a sense of Lewis and his genius, there's a great little YouTube channel that I found. It's called C.S. Lewis Doodles. And if you want, you can go check out that out this week. Everything that he talks about, some amazing artist has found some of the very few recordings of Lewis's voice and put them to a bit of an illustration to help you understand. And I thought I'd share just a little bit and let you hear C.S. Lewis in his own voice today introduce storge. Check this out.
My Greek lexicon defines storge as affection, especially of parents to offspring. And that, I've no doubt, is the original form of the thing, as well as the central meaning of the word. We understand the later, more remote ramifications of it if we start with the right basic image. A mother nursing a baby, a bitch or a cat with a basket full of puppies or kittens, all in a squealing, nuzzling heap together, continuously moving, yet somehow at rest, a warm animal smell and all the noises. But while the original form of storge is thus seen in the nursery or the basket, it branches out in all directions. But however far storge travels from its source, it still retains from it a strong flavor. It's usually the humblest of the loves. It gives itself no airs. Storge is modest, even furtive and shamefaced. Storge has a very homely face, so of many of those for whom we feel it. It's no proof of your cleverness or perceptiveness or refinement that you love them, nor that they love you.
I could say the exact same thing in my accent, and it wouldn't sound nearly as good, would it? It's just amazing. Lewis says that this type of affection, we recognize that it's happening before we ever see its beginning. It's just something that we become aware of, that we love someone, like he said, a mother to a child. It's so interesting, and we'll be honest in here, we're friends. So many of us, we begin our journey with children absolutely enamored and smitten with those little things, right? You just begin to love, and here's the thing. At the very beginning, they look like prematurely aged little old men. Your baby, I'm sure, was cute. Mine were amazing. But really, on the outside, they just make a mess of everything and keep you awake. There's no reason that we should love them, except that we just do. There's something innate in storge love. But it's not just instinct. It's actually a divine design for human relationships that God builds his family, the church, on. That's what we're going to look at today. Now, you don't earn this kind of love by being good enough for it, as Lewis said, or being pretty enough for it, or being accomplished enough for it. You simply are loved because you're familiar. Kind of like a dog, he says, where a dog will see someone that it knows and begin to wag its tail, even if that person has never done them any good. Contrasting, the dog will bark at someone it doesn't know, even if it's never done them any harm. This is the idea of a familiar affection of storge. Storge quietly endures differences. Actually, this is one of the things that makes it so powerful, is that when you experience this love, like say in your family, you can put up with things that otherwise, if you were choosing your friends, you might not choose to be in relationship with. I love it. My wife is one of four girls. It's part of the sisterhood that extends the estrogen palooza that is my life, just women everywhere. And one of them is here with our nieces this weekend, and it's so fun to watch them, although all four of them are completely different. They have different ways of viewing the world and different gifts, and yet when they are together, there is a power of love that is just, it's just palpable. And this is what God intended for the family of God as well. That we would be able to handle the differences in the way that we think and act and cook and eat and vote and all of the other things that make us unique individuals. We should, under the banner of God's family, be able to handle those differences and remain in love. So it's a powerful foundational force. But the place where it gets most displayed, and the place that I want to spend a few minutes today to talk to you about, is within the family. Now, I'm going to talk for the next few minutes about parenting. I'm going to talk about children. I'm going to tell you right now two things. One, if you don't have kids yet, this is still for you. If you are a child, this is for you. And certainly if you are or have been a parent, this is for you. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I am not an expert on any of it. Just ask my girls. But we're all in process of learning how to love better. This type of storge love, Paul writes and says, is to be on display in the household of God, in the church. In fact, in Romans 12:10, he says this, be devoted to one another in love. That love is philostorge. It's a type of this family affection. And then honor one another above yourselves. One of the things that we see in this verse and that I try to tell you guys a lot is that love is not a feeling in and of itself. It doesn't stop with feelings. It actually begins with the feeling, and sometimes it begins with just a choice. For real love is this. If you've ever been in premarital counseling with me, or if you've sat through a sermon where I talked about love before, I always use this same definition. Love is to will and to work for the good of someone else. Real love is to desire the good and then to go about doing things to bring that good for someone else. That is love. So what does that look like in a parent-child relationship? What does it look like if we want to have strong and solid households, families that are attached and secure? How do we put to use this type of love? Because there's good family love. And those experiences that we have, maybe some of you grew up in a household that was full of this. And if you did, you experienced some benefits that some other people who didn't have that luxury don't. We're told from psychology and the medical profession that if you had a good sense of love in the family, you experience higher immune system functioning, less depression, less stress, less prone to heart attacks. You actually can develop secure attachments with people. You can live in settings with better mental health than many of the other folks. But here's the thing. This kind of love, even in its best form, it can be corrupted really quickly. Storge love, this affection, this familiarity that makes you want to include someone even if they're different, like a mother who can love her terrible child, even though he may have done some of the most dastardly things, she still loves him. That kind of love can get perverted, even corrupted. And one of the ways that it does is the person giving the love, the parent, begins to be unable to live without the response of the child. Sometimes as parents, we get to this place where we need them to need us. Codependency is a form of the corrupted version of storge love. It starts out so innocently, right? These little kids, they can't do anything for themselves. They're so cute. They're so in need of us. And we enjoy the feeling of being needed. And then when they get older and they start to have these things called their own opinions, and they construct their own worldview, and suddenly everything that we thought was right is not in their eyes, we begin to get upset. And in fact, this is where storge can turn. Because it love, like all forms of love, ultimately want to say, mine. Love makes us want to hold, say, you're mine. And only God's supernatural love can do that and stay healthy. So I'm going to show you a story of storge that's done right and that's gone wrong in the same story. It's found in a little part of the Old Testament in 1 Samuel, and the story is going to have three main characters in it, a lady named Hannah, her son named Samuel, and a priest named Eli. Eli also has a couple of sons, Hophni and Phinehas, that are just ridiculously terrible, and you'll hear more about them in a moment. But in our story, we're going to see an example of one parent who does love right and one who does it wrong. And at the end of all this, I'm going to ask you to consider with me where we might be able to not only learn from, but experience this kind of good love. Here's how it goes. 1 Samuel chapter 1. Starting in verse 20. There was a lady that was named Hannah. She had wanted a child so badly, but never had been able to have one. Every year she would go to what's called the tent of meeting, or the place that would eventually become like a temple. It was where the people were worshiping God. She would go there and she would pray and beg God to have a child. Every year she was denied. And one year, she was particularly upset. She goes to the tent of meeting, and she's there praying and just mumbling quietly to herself. And this old priest named Eli sees her, although Eli's not real observant. He catches her sitting by herself, mumbling, and he thinks she's drunk. That's going to come into play a little bit more later. Eli doesn't see things exactly the way that they are. And he tells this poor, bereaving, barren woman to get out of there. It's no form of love at all. Not the kind of love that especially a shepherd of the flock of God's people should be. She says to him, I'm not drunk. I'm just begging God for a child. And Eli does something, one of the few things that he does really well in life. He blesses her. With his words, he makes the reality come into being. May the Lord give you this child. We read this in verse 20. So, in the course of time, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, because I asked the Lord for him. From the very beginning, Hannah realizes that this kid is a gift from God, something that's real important for you and me. All of our children are not meant for us to own, to live vicariously through. They're not just extensions of our DNA so that the traces of us don't get wiped off the planet in sort of this evolutionary march forward. Children are actually a purpose. They're a gift from God, and they're a means for us to steward his love. Hannah realizes that the point of having children is actually to introduce them to God and to help them discover their part in this grand plan that he has for the world, to be a part of bringing his goodness to the earth. She recognizes it right away, and she makes an incredible, incredible choice. It says in verse 26, "Pardon me, my Lord." She comes back after having the child, sees Eli, the old man, again at the tent, and she gets his attention. "Pardon me, as surely as you live, I'm that woman that stood here beside you praying to the Lord last year. I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. And because God has done that, so now I give him to the Lord. For his whole life, he will be given over to the Lord." And he worshiped the Lord there. So get this picture. A mom who wanted more than anything an object for her storge love. God answers the prayer, and her response is to say, "God, you're so good, I'm going to give him back to you. I'm not going to hold and grasp. I'm not going to say mine. I'm going to say he's yours." Now, it seems kind of interesting, right? Because she leaves this kid, we're told, at the temple place, and she allows him to be raised by Eli. And that seems like the story just reads as if she drops him off, says bye, and that's it. But you and I know full well that any parent that would make this decision is paying an incredible price. I want you to think about what this little 4 or 5-year-old kid, we're told that she used to come and bring him little robes every year. I love the details in the scriptures. Can you imagine what this little 4-year-old is thinking? Mom's leaving me here? Sure, she's making the decision that she knows is right, but for the kid, it's got to feel like abandonment. And I'm sure she's thinking, is he going to hate me forever? She does the harder right thing because it's in the best interest of the child. She makes a decision to point him to his real father, to the one who can give him the real love that he needs. That's picture one, Hannah and Samuel. Then we come to picture two, contrasting Eli, not quite as rosy. It says this in verse 12 of 1 Samuel chapter 2. "Eli's sons were scoundrels." Tell us how you really feel. "They had no regard for the Lord." Now his sons are priests. This is what's crazy. They are actually the people who are supposed to mediate God to the children of Israel. Their job is like me and Pastor Shannon and others here to be the ones to speak on behalf of God and to help you to connect to God, to learn about him, to grow in him. This is Eli's sons. "But they were scoundrels. They had no regard for the Lord," it says. "And the sin of the young men was very great in the Lord's sights, for they were treating the Lord's offering with contempt." You can read more about it. But basically, when people would bring their sacrifice, it's supposed to help them get past their sin, be reconnected to God, the boys would steal it and eat it. It doesn't make any sense to us, right? But imagine if you brought your offering in, or you came and brought your prayers and asked to meet with someone to pray and ask God for forgiveness, and instead we twisted that, we used the money on ourselves, or we twisted your prayers to try to manipulate you for our own good. These were scoundrels. Goes on, it says, "Now Eli, who was very old, had heard about everything his sons were doing to all of Israel and how they slept with the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. So they're stealing the sacrifices, taking the money, and sleeping with the help that's supposed to have this ready. These guys are awful." So he said to them, and I have to put my own way of speaking here for him, "Why do you do such things?" He's so passive. He's so blind. In fact, it keeps telling us over and over in the story that he has trouble seeing. We see already that he can't see Hannah for her real situation. Now he can't see his kids for how awful they are. "Why do you do such things? I hear from all the people about these wicked deeds of yours. Ah, boys will be boys. His sons, however, did not listen to their father's rebuke, for it was the Lord's will to put them to death. And then, just so we're reminded, but the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and favor with the Lord and with people. Two completely different outcomes. Two kids whose parents show vastly different ways of love. Hannah on the one who's willing to give whatever she can, whatever she has, so that they can become all they're meant to be. Eli on the other, who is so afraid of his own boys, he can't even call out their wrong. See, this is the problem with Eli's parenting and with ours. We have some of these same issues. The problems because of flawed storge are a fear of confrontation, a lack of discipline, ignoring bad behavior. We're told that Eli, he was in charge. He allowed this to keep going on. So much so that God decided to kill his kids. That's not the God that you and I think about in this month of love, is it? But do you know why? It's because these folks were guarding the entrance, the connection to God himself. This was a matter of injustice. And for those of you that have ever experienced injustice, this is a good reminder. God will always bring justice. See, they were keeping people, outsiders, from ever connecting to the Lord. And he said, I won't have that. And parents, this is the issue. If we don't parent well, the consequences can be disastrous. And if it causes people to be unable to experience God, sometimes the consequences are tragic. It really matters how well we parent. How many of you are starting to sweat? Feel a little nervous? How many of you are thinking back to your own life like your time is over? You've already done it. You're like, oh no. It's a really big deal. Sometimes we have this saying, love is blind, you know? But it's not. G.K. Chesterton, who was one of C.S. Lewis's great influences, said this: love is not blind. That's the last thing that it is. Real love is not. Love is bound. And the more it is bound, the less it is blind. Translation, whenever you actually love, when you will and work for the good of your child, you don't ignore the stuff in them that's leading them away from God. You see it all the more clearly. And because of your covenant, your connection, because how much you are intimately bound to them, you go into action. That's real love. And can I just be honest for a second? And I'm not going to look at Jessica right now. That's my wife, for those of you that don't know. This is a hard part for me as a parent. Just being completely vulnerable. And maybe it's true for a lot of dads. In fact, I know it is. I know that passive parenting from a dad is a real thing because there's a candle in my office that my wife got me. It's called Fatherhood. It smells so good. It smells like good leather. But on the candle itself, it says Fatherhood. Smells like saying yes when mom says no. And this is one of our great temptations, is that we are afraid sometimes to engage with our kids, to correct for fear, for corrupted storge love, for fear that they might stop being our friend. If you had a parent, maybe, especially the kind of parent that was authoritarian in style, somebody that didn't show you a lot of love and affection, it's a big temptation. Sometimes we're afraid. We don't want to say things that could hurt. We don't want to damage. And I'm telling you, walking through this myself, I recognize what a danger that is. There's four major types of parenting in psychology. Some of you know this. But studies talk about these four, and all of them have the potential to derail children. It looks like this. There's authoritarian style, which is the because I said so. No connection, no emotion, it's just rules, rules, rules. And sometimes we use that one. And then there's the permissive style that says, I can't tell you anything that might disappoint you or upset you. And it's funny, sometimes we think if we don't say hard things, it's the reason we don't do it is because we love them so much, but actually it's a lack of love. And then there's the neglectful style. That's just bad. That's just when you don't care, you're not involved. But then there's this authoritative style, and this is a storge love kind of style. When you set good boundaries with clear expectations, hold to high standards, and then also display love and commitment and support. This is the aim that we all should have. To try to learn how to parent our kids, the scripture tells us to raise them, to train them up in the way they should go. That our job is to connect them, to introduce them to Christ as an early age, as early as possible, and to teach them about the values of the kingdom. And then, in the greatest move of love, to actually let them go. The point of love is to raise kids of independence. But there's a part of us that wants to hold, isn't there? That wants to keep them close. What can set us free from all that? What can keep us from being like Eli, the kind who's willing to look past that which the children do that's wrong? What would help us be brave, courageous, strong, loving parents? There's only one thing, and each of the human loves we're going to look at this week or this month has to have this additional ingredient added, and it's the supernatural love of God. If you haven't experienced the unconditional acceptance of God for you, it is really difficult to set someone free because, not because you're afraid of what they might do, it's because you're afraid that your value diminishes when they don't need you anymore. Wow. Lewis says the only way to avoid this is to receive the love of the perfect Father. And did you know that you have one? This is what's so amazing about an intergenerational church. This is the power of a church like ours, that you and I could have a family with a perfect Father even if you don't have a family. This is why I love the fact that we've got from 9 months to 90-something years old all together. Is because no matter what type of family you came from, no matter what type of love you experienced, you and I can learn to love correctly in this environment. And we have to, because this is how we're restored. This is how we're brought back to an understanding of who God really is. See, you have a perfect Father that you've always had, but maybe you never realized. When God is often described as Father in the scriptures, just I'm going to show you a couple of scriptures. You can write these down and think about them later. Psalm 103:13 says, "As a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him." God recognizes you are weak and flawed, and he still loves you. Because the Lord disciplines those he loves, Proverbs 3:12. As a father, the son he delights in. If you're experiencing the discipline of God, recognize it's because he loves you. Because he doesn't want you to turn out like a scoundrel. We're also told, Psalm 27:10, that though my father and mother might forsake me, the Lord will receive me. You may have been left without a family, either because of abandonment or because of estrangement. And if that's your story, the love of God says, come, let me show you what it's like to be loved by a real dad. And then that great passage in Jesus in Matthew 7, where he says, if you, though you're evil, which I feel like, Jesus, that's a little harsh. If you, though you're evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father? You've got the perfect Father, no matter what your father may have looked like. And just remember, he or your mom, they were probably trying their best. Because all of these loves, when not animated by the power of the Holy Spirit and the agape love of God, can go wrong. The Father has storge love, this kind of love, this affection, this familiarity for you and for the church that he's building. And so we're going to learn over the next couple weeks how to build on this foundation to love each other better. Jesus said before his death that actually the way that people would know that we are his disciples was not the songs that we sang, not the theology that we could quote, not the scripture that we read or the hours of prayer that we spent, although all of those things are really good and really important. He said, they will know you are my disciples by the way you love each other. It starts with this. It starts here because Jesus made it possible. The gospel message is that it made it possible for you to have God as your Father again. That's the thing about this. It's not automatic. We have to choose to allow his life and death and resurrection to be that which allows the adoption papers to come through. Paul said it like this in Galatians 4, because you are his sons and daughters, God sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, the one who calls out, Abba, Father. You can call him Father because you're no longer a slave, but his child. And if a child, then an heir. So I want to pause right here. We'll continue our lessons next week. Actually, a guest preacher, Lori Short, is going to be here to preach on Eros love. I figured you didn't want to hear me talk about that, and you're welcome. And we're going to build over this month a set of tools to love really, really well. And my prayer would be that God would bless this community through us as we learn to do it. Will you join me in prayer? God, thank you for these stories, the ones of success and beauty and the ones of failure. Thank you that that is true of each of us and each of our families. There are places where we have done this really well, and there are moments where we have absolutely been a disaster. And in both, your compassion on us, it never runs out. Grace just never stops. God, for those who remember right now and actually even feel the twinge of guilt over places in the past where they failed, I pray that your mercy and grace would come and meet that guilt with forgiveness. I pray for those of us that are in the middle of learning how to do this with kids, God, with young people that we mentor, with all the different opportunities we have to extend this love, I pray that you would empower us. I pray that you would motivate us, not with do more mentality, but with looking at you on the cross and recognizing it's already done. We can live freely. We don't have to say mine to anyone or anything because you have said mine to us. We love you, Jesus. In your name we pray.